KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
With these actions, we will begin the complete restoration of America and the revolution of common sense.
President Trump's first day back in the White House brings a blizzard of executive actions from immigration to energy policy.
From Monday, January 20th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, Joe Biden issued a bunch of preemptive pardons on his way out of the White House.
We'll explain who was on the list and why.
Also, here in Los Angeles, a teenager is helping classmates and others who lost everything in the wildfires.
Every girl that walks in, they get a professional stylist to come and help them rebuild their wardrobe.
Plus, the artist Yola on her new album, My Way.
I'm going to have to find a way to get you to act in a way that does not massively violate all of my boundaries.
And a recap of the weekend's NFL playoff games.
Those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Donald Trump has been sworn in today in Washington as the nation's 47th president after achieving something only one other president before him has done, win re-election to a non-consecutive second term. The first was Grover Cleveland in the late 1800s. Trump, during inauguration, was moved into the Capitol Rotunda because of cold weather, promising another golden age for America.
From this moment on, America's decline is over.
Trump also laid out a blitz of executive actions, including efforts to reduce prices.
I will direct all members of my cabinet to marshal the vast powers at their disposal to defeat what was record inflation and rapidly bring down costs and prices.
Later at Washington's Capital One Arena and at the White House, Trump has been signing executive actions, among them freezing federal hiring except the military, rescinding the previous Biden administration actions. And tonight he pardoned 1,500 people involved in the January 6 protests. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports the directives will address a wide range of issues that Trump has promised on day one, including policies that would dramatically overhaul U.S. border and immigration policy.
The flurry of executive actions is a show of strength as Trump aims to roll back Biden administration policies and reinstate orders from his first term in office. Matthew Dalek is a presidential historian at George Washington University.
He is going to use his power and then try to push the boundaries of the Constitution to enact what he said he would enact. Beyond that, though, I think that some seem quite audacious and or unconstitutional and problematic.
Many of Trump's executive actions, including ending birthright citizenship, are likely to be met with legal challenges. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The Senate has unanimously confirmed Florida Republican Marco Rubio to be the next Secretary of State, NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
Once he's sworn in, Rubio is expected to dive into work, hosting foreign ministers from India, Japan, and Australia at the State Department. The group, known as the Quad, is a key partnership in the Pacific and part of the U.S. efforts to counter China's influence. The three ministers are in Washington for Trump's inauguration. Marco Rubio has been a hawkish voice in the Senate on China, and in his confirmation hearing, he described China as a potent and dangerous adversary. He said the U.S. needs to build up its domestic industrial base so that Americans won't have to depend so much on goods from China. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Martin Luther King Jr. Day celebrations are being held across the country today, including at King's former congregation in Atlanta, where a 70-member choir performed Hallelujah. During the ceremony at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, there was also a warning from Dr. King's daughter, the Reverend Bernice King, about anti-woke rhetoric she says is being used to divide and distract people from real issues of injustice. Residents across the U.S. are facing frigid temperatures this week, even in the typically balmy Gulf South. Arby Druhaus of member station WWNO reports from New Orleans.
Some parts of Louisiana could get record-breaking snowfall, and at least a few inches of snow and sleet, as well as ice, are forecast for pretty much the entire region. Here's the state's governor, Jeff Landry.
This creates a very dangerous situation, not only for travel, but for people pipes, pets, and plants.
Louisiana is borrowing plows and salt spreaders from Arkansas, since the state doesn't have its own. Still, Landry says some roads and bridges will be closed, and people should plan to stay home.
This is the time when you can cook you a big pot of gumbo.
You won't even have to keep it in the refrigerator, he says. Just put it outside. For NPR News, I'm Aubrey Yuhas in New Orleans.
While U.S. financial markets are closed today for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday and the U.S. presidential inauguration, the cryptocurrency Bitcoin has been surging on global markets, Bitcoin rising above $109,000 earlier today. Donald Trump on the campaign trail vowed to make the U.S., quote, the crypto capital of the world. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include EBSCO, supporting open source technology and making open platforms possible for libraries of all sizes. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington. This afternoon, it became official. President Trump was sworn into office, and he vowed to immediately get to work.
Today, I will sign a series of historic executive orders. With these actions, we will begin the complete restoration of America and the revolution of common sense.
And tonight he began to do that with a barrage of executive actions rolling back the policies of now former President Joe Biden. It's a dramatic move straight out of the gate, reflecting Trump's desire to make the most of these first few critical months in office. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez is at the White House. Hi, Franco.
Hey, Ari.
What do these first executive actions do?
Well, I mean, he really made a show of these first set of actions. I mean, he sat down at this small desk in the center of Capital One Arena, where he began to sign dozens of executive actions in front of thousands of supporters who were there for his indoor parade. He started off by launching a full-scale assault on Biden's legacy, revoking nearly 80 executive actions that were taken by the Biden administration. He then drove to the White House, where he signed several more in the Oval Office. Those included pardons for 1,500 people related to the January 6 riots at the U.S. Capitol. He also signed an order designating cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, and he signed one creating the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, of course, led by Elon Musk.
So the big topic here is clearly immigration, which we'll talk about more in another part of the show. But what's the significance of him doing all of this today, right away?
Well, I mean, it really shows how far Trump is willing to go to make up for basically lost time and expand his presidential powers. I mean, he declared a national emergency on the border as well. And he also signed an order to end birthright citizenship for the children whose parents are here in the country without legal status. Some of these steps, like birthright citizenship, will no doubt face legal challenges.
Since it is, of course, protected by the Constitution. In his inaugural address, we heard him call for a revolution of common sense. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, that is how he describes his agenda. But when it comes to executive orders, he's really leaning into the culture wars that were a big part of his campaign.
I will also end the government policy of trying to socially engineer race and gender into every aspect of public and private life.
And he promised to roll back protections for transgender people. He's going to sign an executive order stating that it's policy for the U.S. to recognize two biologically distinct sexes, male and female. And an incoming White House official actually told us that the government will use these definitions for official documents like passports and employee records.
You've been talking about a lot of domestic agenda items. Are there foreign policy moves as well?
Yeah. I mean, a theme of the campaign has been about the U.S.'s position in the world. Trump did say he still intends to put tariffs on Mexico and Canada, but is looking in February as a target date. He also promised an executive order that signals America's place as, quote, the greatest, most respected nation on earth.
A short time from now, we are going to be changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America.
He had some other name changes, too. What happens now that he has signed these executive actions? Do they immediately take effect?
Well, I mean, some will take effect immediately. Others will face legal challenges. For example, you can expect a court challenge against Trump's plan to reclassify tens of thousands of federal workers so that they can basically be more easily fired and replaced with loyalists. Ari, no question, there's a lot to be hashed out, but a lot of changes.
NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez on day one of the Trump presidency. Thank you.
Thank you, Ari.
Many people are beginning to venture back into their burned or damaged homes in Los Angeles, or they're cleaning up the toxic ash that's spread across the region. Alejandra Barunda from NPR's Climate Desk talked to experts about how to safely approach the cleanup process.
UCLA pulmonologist Reza Ranaghi lost his house in the Pacific Palisades in last week's fires.
Not a single house survived in our kind of two-block area, so the street before ours and the street after ours.
A few days later, city officials let Ranaghi and a group of his neighbors back to assess the damage. He wore an N95 mask, but he quickly realized the mask wasn't enough. In less than half an hour...
You know, my eyes were watering. Even with my N95, I could still smell the smoke, and so I was coughing.
The short-term health impacts are one thing, but Ranaghi's more worried about the long-term risks of exposure.
But now you're dealing with organic volatiles that come from the burning of the house, the roof, the appliance, right?
Couches, coolants, refrigerators. Burning all that releases a potentially toxic mix, from carcinogenic gases like benzene to heavy metals or asbestos fibers. It's present in the ash and smoke, not only in the destroyed neighborhoods, but across the city.
Those are actually much more dangerous than what smoke may do to your lungs alone, right? Now we're talking long-term consequences.
Scientists still don't totally know what those health consequences are. But after the Lahaina wildfires in 2023, residents exposed to smoke and ash experienced increases in heart, kidney, and mental health issues. Ranaghi was really worried that people in LA didn't know the risks, so he started alerting people to take precautions when they went back.
To our few friends and family and neighbors, it's just been either text message or phone calls.
N95s or even respirators. Gloves, goggles, long pants, the whole protective shebang. Ranaghi's house was totally destroyed, but many other people's homes weren't burned to the ground, and they're now filled with toxic smoke and ash. Colleen Reed is a health geographer at the University of Colorado Boulder. She studied the lingering health impacts of smoke and ash in people's homes after Colorado's Marshall Fire in 2021. Like Ranaghi, she says take the cleanup risks seriously because the ash can get back into the air.
We found that when people cleaned, it resuspended that ash. We could measure that the PM levels went up. So, like, you want to wear a mask that's protecting you from that.
Or even consider hiring professional environmental cleaners. Yosti Gao is another University of Colorado Boulder scientist. He was part of a different study after the Marshall Fire that looked at how deep smoke got into people's houses.
That smoke managed to penetrate indoors through cracks underneath doors, windows, etc.
And not just that, dangerous gases like benzene and formaldehyde came in with the smoke too.
What happened to the gases, in part, was that they got absorbed into building materials.
Wood framing and maybe even drywall, along with furniture and mattresses. The gases stuck around for up to 5 weeks. DeGau's group found that running activated carbon air filters constantly could suck away those dangerous gases. That, plus wiping down surfaces again and again, will go a long way toward making your home safe again. For NPR News, I'm Alejandra Barunda.
This weekend, the NFL had it all. A big upset, a blow-for-blow showdown between two MVP candidates, a true snow game, and maybe the worst performance of all came from the only squad that appeared in all four games, the refs. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is here with a recap. Hey, Becky.
Hi.
I'm here in Washington, D.C., so are you. Can't help but notice this weekend was a big one for the hometown Commanders.
You bet. And before we talk about them, a little rest in peace to the 2024 Detroit Lions, who all season long looked like the team to beat, seemed like they were going to be a lock for the Super Bowl. And it was like a feel-good story, a team that has not only not won a Super Bowl before, but not even appeared in one, but they were hit by this like tidal wave of injuries to their defense over the season that set them back. They also turned the ball over five times on Saturday night, and They simply ran into this 24-year-old buzzsaw named Jaden Daniels, who is Washington's rookie quarterback.
Yeah, so back to the Commanders. Seems like he has been playing great all year long.
Absolutely, yeah. I think he's a lock for Offensive Rookie of the Year. And it's crazy because, you know, transitioning to the NFL is usually hard, even for the most talented prospects, especially for quarterbacks. Often they are taken by the very worst team, so they're walking into the worst situations. One result of that is that no rookie quarterback has ever started a Super Bowl for his team. Hmm. But Jaden Daniels and the Washington Commanders are just one win away from that. Wow. So to do that, next weekend, they will have to beat the Philadelphia Eagles, who themselves looked very solid in a snowy game, win over the Los Angeles Rams last night. Their star Saquon Barkley, their running back, looked incredible. These two teams, the Commanders and the Eagles, have played twice in the regular season already. They split those two games 1-1, so it's anybody's guess who takes this one.
Okay, so Commanders or Eagles versus who? Who's going to go to the Super Bowl?
Yeah, that's going to come down to the Kansas City Chiefs and the Buffalo Bills. So the Chiefs beat the Houston Texans to reach what is a seventh straight conference championship for them. That is crazy. They are aiming to win their third straight Super Bowl, which would be a first in the history of the NFL. To do so, they'll have to beat the Buffalo Bills, who have never won a Super Bowl. They lost four in a row in the early 90s, famously. They earned their spot with a Sunday night win over the Baltimore Ravens. Baltimore quarterback Lamar Jackson is an astonishingly good player. He may likely win his third MVP award this season, but he had two bad turnovers last night. And just overall, this lack of playoff success for the Ravens, I think, has got to be frustrating. And it just goes to show how tough I think the AFC is for quarterbacks. You have Mahomes with the Chiefs, Allen with the Bills, Lamar Jackson with the Ravens. Incredible that really only one of them can make it out, make it to the Super Bowl.
Aside from all the players, referees got a lot of attention this weekend. What happened?
Yeah, I should start by saying that reffing an NFL game in real time is hard. The game moves so fast in real life. There's a lot of things to look at on every play. The NFL does review calls every game, every week. They say overall about 99% of calls are right, but the 1% can be bad, and this weekend there were some really bad ones. A couple calls against defenders who were tackling Patrick Mahomes of the Kansas City Chiefs really got fans and commentators worked up, and I think for good reason. There are some questionable calls that led to points in the other games too. The NFL has gotten replay officials more involved this year. I think there will be some pressure building to expand that to get more of these big time penalties right going forward.
Lots to watch. NPR's Becky Sullivan, thank you for the recap.
You're welcome.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester, with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Just hours before leaving office, former President Joe Biden took the rare step of issuing preemptive pardons for potential targets of his successor. The list includes members of the House Select January 6th committee that investigated the attack on the Capitol. Speaking to supporters in an overflow room in the Capitol, President Trump lobbed personal insults against two of the Republican committee members.
Why are we helping Liz Cheney? I mean, Liz Cheney is a disaster. She's a crying lunatic and crying Adam Kinzinger. He's a super crying. I never saw the guy not crying. He's always crying.
Biden's pardons also included retired General Mark Milley and Dr. Anthony Fauci. And at the last minute before Trump was sworn in, Biden also added preemptive pardons for five of his own family members. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales is covering this issue. Hey, Claudia.
Hey, Ari.
Okay, so this is one of Biden's final actions as president. Walk us through how he defended it.
Right. He said in a statement issued hours before he left office that the preemptive pardons were needed because of, quote, unjustified and politically motivated prosecutions by the Trump administration. He went on to say, as reported by our colleague Tamara Keith, that the issuance of these pardons should not, quote, be mistaken as acknowledgement that any individual engaged in any wrongdoing. And we know, for example, Fauci was targeted for his role as a top advisor during the pandemic, Milley for making statements against Trump and detailing his role in the January 6th attack, which of course was the reason that that committee was targeted as well. In a separate statement, Biden issued pardons for those family members. As we mentioned, that includes his brother, James Biden. And he argued they had been unfairly targeted.
We heard Trump's reaction there at the top. How have other Republicans responded?
There is a level of fury for Republicans focused on retribution for these folks, that pardons could derail their plans now. At the same time, we know there's a lot of division within the Republican Party on whether to pursue this revenge on Trump's behalf. For example, nominated Attorney General Pam Bondi told senators that there would be no political prosecutions on her watch.
Were the people who got these pardons surprised?
In some cases, yes. But for these more high-profile folks, no. Discussions have been ongoing for months behind closed doors on whether they would benefit from these pardons. Both Fauci, Milley, and the House Select Committee all issued statements. Fauci and the committee, for example, expressed sentiments of gratitude. The committee itself, there was even division over this in past months. I learned they met behind closed doors, but by issuing a joint statement, it signaled they were on the same page. Meanwhile, Milley said he didn't want to drag family and friends through a retribution campaign.
The list is pretty far-reaching. It even includes congressional aides to the House Select Committee. What are people saying about how this could all play out now under the Trump administration?
Well, there's plenty of legal uncertainties on how it will play out. For example, this was a surprise for those staffers for the January 6th panel. According to a source not authorized to speak on the record, they told me they didn't expect this. And this would include more than 50 congressional aides that worked with the committee. But now there's questions of how exactly this will play out if these folks are indeed targeted for prosecution by the Trump administration.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thousands of people have lost their homes in the devastating Los Angeles fires. Many escaped with just the clothes on their backs. And for 14-year-old Avery Colvert, the thought of losing her clothes and makeup was unbearable. Colvert School in Altadena burned, but her home did not. So she set out to help others. Reporter Robin Estrin of member station KCRW tells us how.
A dozen girls line up at a warehouse in East Los Angeles, outside the fire zone. Ash floats through the air. Many wear pajama bottoms or sweatpants, like 11-year-old Jasmine Navarro. She lost her house in the Eaton fire, and she says her Christmas presents and favorite hair oil.
It's been very sad. I've been very emotional lately, but
I'm sure I'll get better.
In fact, things are about to get a lot better, if only for a few hours. Inside the warehouse, Avery Colvert and a team of volunteers have created a shopping mall for the girls who've lost everything. There are rows of shoes and racks of neatly organized clothing. Tables brim with colorful earrings and beauty supplies. Everything here is brand new, and it's all free. Avery wants it to feel like retail therapy.
Every girl that walks in, they get a nice tote bag, and they get a professional stylist to come and help them rebuild their wardrobe.
That's right, a professional stylist. It is LA, after all. Avery got the idea for this after her home filled with smoke and her family evacuated.
I thought about my own room and I thought about myself and how my clothes and the way I do my hair and my makeup is so important to my identity and my confidence. And these people, especially girls, teenage girls, they lost that piece of identity when they lost all their things.
So she started the Instagram page Altadena Girls and put out a call for donations. Other organizations were collecting necessities like food and water. She wanted what a lot of teenage girls want, baggy jeans, pimple patches, and curly hair products.
And I want to be able to give it back, and they have a sense of normalcy in their lives when nothing else is normal, and I want them to walk out feeling confident again.
Avery's idea took off. Boxes of clothes from trendy brands poured in. Charlie XCX sent bags of beauty products. Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, volunteered as a stylist. And so have dozens of Hollywood producers and LA fashion industry professionals. Ruby Burns is one of them. She wears all black and a headset that connects to the team sorting all those donations in the back. She quotes a post she saw on Instagram.
Of course, in a city with a million production coordinators, did you think that the response to this disaster was going to be Of course not.
The warehouse buzzes with stylists helping girls choose outfits. CJ Racco asks 12-year-old Agnes McLean about her aesthetic.
Kind of like a tomboy, kind of like skater look.
Agnes, who's Avery's classmate, lost her home in the fire. CJ digs into a rack of clothes.
Black cargo pants? Oh, yeah. These are so cool. Okay. These are for you, my dear.
Nearby, Jasmine, who was waiting in line earlier, picks out pink nail polish.
And by the way, my favorite color is pink, so I have a lot of pink stuff.
Just then, YouTube famous makeup artist James Charles pulls up. Agnes rushes over.
Can I take a photo with you?
Let's do it.
Agnes's mom, Liz McLean, watches from nearby.
To see their classmate do something like this and take action, this is going to be a memory for them that just doesn't go away.
In a city with a reputation for superficiality, eighth grader Avery Colvert and her army of producers and stylists are showing the world that Angelenos are beautiful on the inside, too. For NPR News, I'm Robin Estrin in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Even before he was sworn in for the second time, President Trump promised a lot of quick fixes.
You're going to see executive orders that are going to make you extremely happy. Lots of them. Lots of them.
The president's first day back in office. Tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, we'll hear from people in Washington, D.C. about how they experienced today's inauguration ceremony at Capital One Arena.
So I got here at 12:30 a.m. and I have not slept. That's why I'm in the line for coffee.
That story's coming up after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Donald Trump returns to the White House as the nation's 47th president, taking charge as the Republican Party takes the reins in Washington, D.C., with plans to reshape the country's institutions. Meanwhile, former President Joe Biden spoke to members of his administration at a send-off ceremony, this shortly after Trump's inauguration.
We're leaving office. We're not leaving the fight. You're smart. You're skilled. You're passionate. The country needs you again. So all of you can stay engaged in all the ways you can, whether it's in public service, the private sector, philanthropy, academia, running for office yourself, or anything else you choose to do. I give you my word, we believe in you.
Biden pardoned the heads of the January 6th committee, retired General Mark Milley and Dr. Anthony Fauci, whom Trump has called political thugs. A new lawsuit against President Trump claims his so-called Department of Government Efficiency violates federal transparency rules. It's the newly created group headed by Tesla CEO Elon Musk, whose mission is to revamp the federal government. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
The lawsuit was brought by two public interest nonprofits and a union representing some 800,000 government employees. It argues that Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, known as DOGE, is not in fact a government agency, but a kind of advisory committee tasked with recommending drastic cuts to government agencies and programs. The plaintiffs note that under federal law, such committees must have a, quote, fair balance in viewpoints represented, and that the work must be made available for public inspection. The lawsuit asks that DOGE be blocked from operating until those requirements are met. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Well, trading resumes tomorrow on Wall Street after today's Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. This is NPR. The daughter of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. says anti-woke rhetoric is being used to divide the country. Bernice King made the remarks today during an annual tribute to her father at Ebenezer Baptist Church, as Dormaya Vance reports.
The event at the church where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was once pastor featured a number of guests, civil rights leaders, city officials, and his youngest daughter.
So as we commemorate the King holiday, stand at the dawn of a new presidential era under Donald Trump, we find ourselves at a critical juncture in our nation's history where the very foundations of freedom, justice, and democracy that my father fought so tirelessly to build are being shaken.
Bernice King said that anti-woke rhetoric has become a weapon to distract from real issues of injustice. President Trump has vowed to roll back diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the federal government. For NPR News, I'm Dormaya Vance in Atlanta.
8 years ago, top music performers largely avoided Trump's inauguration ceremonies, but not this time around. Singer Carrie Underwood sang America the Beautiful during today's inauguration, with several others performing at Trump's inaugural balls, including Nelly, country singer Jason Aldean, and Billy Ray Cyrus, among others. Many of these mainstream performers enthusiastically associating with the new administration. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump was sworn into office earlier today and has now signed a series of executive actions related to immigration. They are the first steps in a sweeping immigration crackdown for Trump's second term. He laid out some of these proposals in his inaugural address in the U.S. Capitol Rotunda.
All illegal entry will immediately be halted, and we will begin the process of returning millions and millions of criminal aliens back to the places from which they came.
Now, many of the details of Trump's agenda are still unclear, but that agenda is very likely to face logistical and legal challenges. NPR's Joel Rose has been following all of this and joins us now. Hi, Joel.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so what do we know as of now about all of these executive actions on immigration?
Well, Trump said in his inaugural address that he is declaring a national emergency at the southern border and that he will send U.S. troops there. He pledged to use the full and immense power, as he put it, of federal and state law enforcement to round up, arrest, and deport immigrants with criminal records. That could happen really at any time. Mm-hmm. Trump also said he would designate drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. All of this is part of an ambitious agenda that could reshape border security and immigration policy in the U.S. for a very long time. And it goes well beyond what Trump tried to do in his first term. But as in his first term, much of this agenda will likely encounter legal challenges.
Right. Okay, so what policies do you think are most likely to be challenged?
I would start with the president signed an executive action aimed at ending birthright citizenship for children born to immigrants who are in the U.S. without legal status. Many legal scholars say that would be unconstitutional, so that is very likely to be challenged in court and maybe in Congress as well. Trump officials also say the administration will seek to cut off illegal entry at the southern border, even for people who are seeking asylum, including those fleeing from war and oppression. That's also very likely to be challenged. And Trump is bringing back some executive actions that might be familiar from his first term, restarting construction of the border wall, suspending refugee resettlement, and reinstating the policy called Remain in Mexico, which forced migrants to wait south of the border while their asylum claims are heard.
Okay, that is a lot. But, I mean, Trump did campaign, and he did win in large part because of his pledge to crack down on immigration and border security, right? So what's been the reaction from his supporters so far?
Yeah, NPR spoke to some Trump supporters who came to town for the inauguration today who told us they were not happy with record levels of illegal immigration during the first part of the Biden administration. For example, Ethan Zhang, who is himself an immigrant from Western China, a green card holder who works in marketing in New York. And Zhang says his neighborhood in Queens deteriorated during the last 4 years, and he blames immigrants who are here with no legal status.
I used to live in Queens. My neighborhood used to be quiet, and when they got in, they play music very loud, and they just don't respect anything, you know.
Okay, and what about immigrant advocates? What are they saying today about all of this?
I talked to Carrie Talbot with the nonprofit Immigration Hub. She says the breadth and cruelty of these executive actions is what stood out for her. And Talbot noted that illegal crossings have already fallen to some of their lowest levels in years.
No, it's not an emergency right now. You know, the Trump administration is just using that language to scare people and to justify really extreme actions.
And real quick, Joel, any other important changes in immigration policy that were announced today?
Yeah, I want to mention the Trump administration has already shut down the CBP One app. This is an app that's allowed tens of thousands of migrants to make appointments to present themselves at the border in order to seek asylum. And closing it down now effectively closes off one of the last legal pathways for doing that.
That is NPR's Joel Rose. Thank you so much, Joel.
You're welcome.
Proposals to put the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms are gaining momentum across the country. Louisiana passed a law requiring it last year, but it's currently blocked by a federal court. Now, Texas lawmakers say they'll pass their version this spring, with other states eyeing it too. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider reports.
When Louisiana passed its Ten Commandments school display law last year, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, a Republican, took to social media. He said Texas should have been the first in the nation to pass such a law, and he swore the state's legislature would do so in 2025. I spoke with Republican State Senator Phil King, who will help lead the effort.
To be honest, if you don't know the Ten Commandments, you don't really know the basis for much of American history and law. It played such a role in our founding and among our founders. In fact, few documents have had a bigger impact on not just the United States, but on Western civilization in general than the Ten Commandments.
Republican State Senator Brandon Creighton heads the Education Committee, and he told me why he wants the Ten Commandments in every classroom.
We can't hold our society back or hamstring the teaching of national pride and basic principles and morality because of someone, some way, somehow being offended of being an American or following principles that simply encourage people not to tell a lie to one another or to dishonor your mother or father. I think that's why our country's in the mess that it's in.
Following Louisiana last year, lawmakers in other states, including North and South Dakota and Tennessee, have introduced Ten Commandments bills. Ever since a 2022 Supreme Court ruling opened the door, states have been pushing the edges on what Robert Tuttle, law professor at Washington, D.C.'s George Washington University, says has been the norm on church and state.
What we're seeing is an effort to extend the range of religious dominance, not religious freedom, but religious dominance in governmental space. And it's very hard to square with longstanding traditions of separation.
One of the people opposing the trend in Texas is Democratic State Representative James Tallarico.
On my first day in office, I put my hand on the Bible and I swore an oath to the Constitution, not the other way around.
Tallarico is currently a seminary student and used to teach in San Antonio public schools.
I think if Jesus read some of these bills, he would remind us to treat Jewish students, Muslim students, Buddhist students, Hindu students, atheist students as ourselves. And that's not what this legislation does.
In 2023, a Ten Commandments bill passed the Senate but died in the House, thanks in part to some Republicans who agreed with Tallarico. But the Texas House shifted further to the right in the last election. Stephen T. Collis teaches religion law at the University of Texas at Austin and outlined the competing views.
Those who are opposed to the Ten Commandments in schools feel like this is an effort to inject Christianity into public schools. Those who are arguing for posting the Ten Commandments would argue the idea that public schools can be neutral is a myth. And what public schools are actually doing is secularizing children and removing from their education any notion that Christianity played a role in the development of Western culture.
While a federal appeals court in New Orleans considers the Louisiana law, Texas supporters say they're determined to push forward. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Hurricane Helene severely damaged western North Carolina's national forests, including a lot of old growth trees that are over 100 years old. Conservationists had hoped those trees would get protection from the Biden administration under a proposal to better manage the forests to withstand climate change. But those hopes were dashed earlier this month when the Forest Service abandoned the idea. Katie Myers of Grist and Blue Ridge Public Radio reports.
Josh Kelly walks softly on the bare winter ground in the Pisgah National Forest near Barnardsville, North Carolina. This is an old growth forest, but he says it's not only the trees that matter.
Places like this that have never been logged is you have this soil profile that is just rich in nutrients and rich in history.
Kelly is a biologist who monitors logging for the advocacy group Mountain True. This is a cove forest because it's between mountain ridges and rugged, so it's been left alone from logging. That means some trees here are hundreds of years old.
Cove forests tend to be a real mix of ages. So while we have some of these big old trees, we've got middle-aged trees, we've got loads of these tiny saplings around.
But it's still considered an old-growth forest, and they've been suffering from a changing climate, says Will Harlan. He is the Southeast Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental advocacy group.
Climate change has been impacting the forests in a couple ways, but the main two are with droughts and floods.
The most recent floods here came with Hurricane Helene in September. It blew down an estimated 187,000 acres of forest in western North Carolina. In 2022, the Biden administration issued an executive order to protect old-growth forests on public land from the effects of climate change. The Forest Service then got to work on what's become known as the National Old-Growth Amendment. Harlan says he had high hopes for it.
One thing about the Old Growth Amendment is it really emphasized the pressure that these forests are under because of climate change.
2.5 years later, after a lot of research and public input, the amendment was shelved. It would have set policy for all national forests on how to manage old growth in light of changing weather patterns. In an email, Forest Service officials did not give a reason for their action, but said they hoped their findings could still be helpful. John Hatcher of the North Carolina State Forestry Association was glad the amendment is on hold. He says it was confusing and didn't allow enough logging around older trees.
When you look at the U.S. Forest Service having over 200 definitions for old growth, it makes it really hard to have something like a universal framework that can be used across the Forest Service's footprint.
It's true old growth means different things in different regions. Most of the old growth east of the Mississippi is in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Out west, old growth is much older. Hatcher says there needs to be room on Forest Service land for recreation and logging.
You can still manage it in a sustainable way that strikes that balance and allows all those other uses while at the same time maintaining a healthy landscape.
But with a changing climate, that's hard to do, says Kelly. If you log too many young trees, it weakens the older ones in extreme weather.
Resilience to storms and blowdowns often depends on the forest around them. So the more of a forest that you have surrounding these bigger, older trees, the more buffered they are from winds and storms.
Without federal protection from climate change, the fight to save this old growth forest will now go local. Kelly and Harlan say they are already gearing up to protect the Pisgah Forest from a logging project. For NPR News, I'm Katie Myers in Barnardsville, North Carolina.
This is NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. It's been years since we've heard from singer Iola, and she says that's by design.
I actually took a bit of time out to get a life. That's why you haven't heard from me, because I didn't have a life. I was like, I was like all work and no play made Jill a very dull girl. And so, yeah, so I sorted my whole life out. It wasn't sorted out. And now I've actually built this thing called a life, which really makes this whole rest of music start making sense.
Making music is something she's been doing for years. Early on, it was with the group Bugs in the Attic. The group's music was heavily influenced by jazz, funk, and soul music. Sounds she says shaped this project.
So this is me writing it for myself with, you know, 80s soul energy, with disco energy, with funk energy. That's what I'm trying to do with this EP. You can definitely hear that in Ready.
When we spoke, she told me about the inspiration for that song.
Ready, as a song, is largely inspired by the Windrush generation. My mother was part of the Windrush generation of people that came over from the Caribbean to the UK because, you know, Europeans broadly lost a lot of people in the Second World War. And as a result of that, they were constantly trying to fill positions. And they coaxed people out of arguably paradise. And I grew up, and people would say, I grew up in a little village outside of Bristol. In the southwest of England, and I got told, like, go home, go back to where you came from. And, like, with all of that kind of preemptive narrative of, you know, coming from paradise to somewhere rainy and miserable where people are telling you to go home, and at least the impetus was to be helpful. It's like, ugh, you're having a laugh, aren't you? That's what the song came out of, this idea of actually, do you know what? You're a genius. If you're going to buy me a flight to Accra, make it in December so I can catch Burna Boy or something like that, please. And like, so it was like, you're telling me to go back to paradise. That sounds like a wonderful deal. And so that song came out of like this idea of turning something that was supposed to be like an insult, like a go back to when you came from, into a, actually, I should. It's a brilliant idea. You've got to be ready, ready, get your things and stand on the Jenny Jenny.
You've got to be ready, ready, pack your bags, meet me on the Jenny Jenny. You know, Iola, I have to say, as I was listening to this EP, it seemed to be infused with this idea of claiming your agency, starting with that title track, My Way. And you really seem to be sending a message in that song. What's the message and who's it for?
The message is I have to negotiate to be centered in my own experience of my own life. And people forget that, you know, when you're doing music, music is, it takes over a lot of your life. And when people kind of go, oh, we want to be able to interact with you as an artist, but not really center you, I'm just going to have to do this my way. I'm going to have to find a way to get you to act in a way that does not massively violate all of my boundaries. Because you don't understand consent. You don't understand collaboration. And so that's really like what that song is for. We're gonna do it my way. God only knows there's nothing I can say.
So we're gonna do it my way. I'm hoping you can tell us about another song on the EP, and that's the song Future Enemies. I know you're feeling how you're feeling, it's a stumble, bitch, this temptation. Feels like, when I listen to it at least, it's the song about seeing and appreciating and swerving and avoiding those red flags and people you come across. Can you tell us about it?
Just, it dawned on me, kind of in the opposite breath of My Way. My Way is like, oh God, I'm stuck here. But Future Enemy is like, you've just met them. And at this point in time, if you've noticed that you're not gonna get on, you have the profound privilege to get out of the situation without making a brand new enemy. You know it's possible, so you just don't need to go that deep. You can get out. It's totally possible to just have a nice interaction and then go like, wow, okay, that was a red flag, but you know what I'm gonna do? Instead of manufacturing a brand new enemy out of thin air for no reason, because it ain't that deep, just be like, cool, that was really great, yeah, all right, and then literally, poof, David Copperfield.
Typically when we end these conversations, we end them with a song. So I'd like to ask you, from your EP, what song should we go out on and why?
Well, we haven't talked about Temporary yet, and maybe that's the one that we need to go out on. You're exactly the kind of guy that I always want to try. Temporary is a song about, can I swear on this, Spooky?
We might have to bleep it.
Okay, so bleep it. I'm going to say it. You ready? Got your bleep button ready?
I'm ready.
Get your finger hovering. There you go. It's about... There you go. There you go. Bleep, boys. and it's about how, like, they have a use. Would you believe?
go on.
I know. You're like... I love the suspicious voice and, like, go on? Really? yes. In that, when you're dating seriously, that can be exhausting. Your hopes get built up, dashed, built up, dashed, built up, dashed, built up. After a while, that's just exhausting. Who can go through that continually? Sometimes you need to date someone who you know is utterly useless, other than they're just pretty. I love singing this song because it just makes me laugh. Like, all the lyrics kind of just make me chuckle because it's a little bit like, you're saying to the babe, at some point this ain't gonna be cute, but you know, let's get what we can out of this. And then I'll go back to my life, which is seriously dating, and you'll go back to your life, which is being utterly vapid.
Yola, thank you so much. It has been such a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much.
We've been talking with Yola. Her new EP is My Way. It's out now.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12. Mathnasium.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at Metamucil.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at Progressive.com/careers.